lecture delivered on January 15, 1986 by Firoz Mehta at the K.R. Kama Oriental Institute, Bombay, on the Divine Dialogue. The Divine Dialogue is one of the outstanding characteristics of the scriptures of the world. There is an ample record of God and man conversing with each other. In several Upanishads, a short question is put or an explanation is requested by some devotee, and an answer comes from one or other of the three persons of the Trinity. In the Maitreya Upanishad, Maitreya is answered by Mahadeva, the great god Shiva. In the Atma Bodha, the teaching is given by Narayana, the Supreme Being. In the Kaivalya, Ashvalayana is answered by Brahma, who also answers Subala in the Subala Upanishad. In the Tejobindu, Kumara the Kartikeya is answered by Shiva. In the Bhagavad Gita, Sri Krishna, who is regarded as God incarnate, answers Arjuna. In the Varaha, Vishnu answers Ribhu. In the Mangala Brahmana, Narayana answers Yajnavalkya. In the Katha, Yama, the Lord of Death, instructs Nachiketas. In the Old Testament, Joseph and Moses see and speak with the Lord face to face. Moses and Elijah go up into the Mount of the Lord for 40 days and nights. This Mount of the Lord of the Old Testament has its counterpart in the Zarathustrian Ushidarena, the Hindu Mount Meru, the Sahasrara Chakra of Kundalini Yoga, the Brahma Loka of Buddhist meditation. The Buddha and his great arahants can spend 7 days and nights in the ultimate deep samadhi or supreme communion known as the cessation, and they can visit and converse with Brahma, the creator god. Again, in the Old Testament, we have statements like these: and Enoch walked with God, and Enoch was not, for God took him. It is not said that he died, as did his six forefathers up to Adam. Again, Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. And when Abram was 90 years and 9, the Lord appeared to Abram and said, "I am the Almighty God. Walk before me and be thou perfect." And the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim. And the Spirit of the Lord came upon Gideon. In St. John's Gospel, here are the words of Jesus: "I have many things to say and to judge of you, but he that sent me, God the Father, is true. And I speak to the world those things which I have heard of him." Chapter 8, verse 26. In verse 28, "As my Father hath taught me, I speak these things." In verse 40, "But now ye seek to kill me, a man that hath told you the truth, which I have heard of God. In chapter 12, verse 50, Jesus affirms positively, whatsoever I speak, even as the Father said unto me, so I speak. What do all these statements mean? We agree and we know for certain that God is not like a human being, not like Pestanji or Ram Lal, Alexander or Gregorovich. God speaks no language of any creature, human or animal, insect or creeping thing, fish of the sea or bird of the air. God is no superhuman being or limited person. God is the supreme unknown, unknowable by us ordinary mortals in his actual Godhood. God is the silence which is the creative sound, the music of the universe which is not played by the cosmos or by anything manifested. For the manifested totality knows only time and space, birth, existence and death, mutability, illness, turmoil and sorrow. Mutability belongs to relativity, but God is the absolute. I repeat, God is the unknown and unknowable. And yet, all those affirmations of seeking God, of conversing with God, and of union with God are true affirmations. Indeed, they are the truest, noblest, most healing and divine affirmations made by man since he first evolved as an upright walking true human some 3.5 million years ago. I will try to show you as simply as I can the living meaning of all these statements, which are neither mere rhetoric nor just exalted poetry. Suppose you have an appointment with some high-placed, important person. And suppose that your future career and the well-being of your family, your loved ones and friends, and even perhaps your whole community depended upon the outcome of this interview. Would you not then take the greatest care to prepare yourself in mind, behavior, and even bodily, the right deportment, suitable clothes, etc., for this occasion when so much depends upon your making the right impression, productive of the best results? Of course you would. What now is the right preparation for your appointment with God? Your appointment with truth, goodness, purity, love, wisdom and beauty. I will try to answer this question in some practical detail in the succeeding talks. For the present, let us consider some admonitory teaching given by spiritual teachers of past ages. Before you can stand in the presence of God, the soul must be completely naked, stripped not only of all its coverings, but also of all its contents. Instead of the word soul, I will use a more suitable word, namely psyche, a gift from the Greeks. What is the psyche? You may remember that in my previous lecture, I suggested that we may regard Ahura Mazda's Kshatra, which is the creative source, as primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy, holding within itself in potentiality the entire cosmos, Menog and Getig, spiritual and material, which emerges out of it. The whole of this creative energy, functioning in a certain mode, we call pure mind, Vohumana. Functioning in another mode, we call it Asha, order, virtue. In still another way, Armaiti, divine devotion or transcendent love, etc., etc. Mind is the great formative agent. It is the transcendent source of our knowingness, our consciousness, just as Asha is the transcendent source of instinctive animal behavior and of purity, virtue, and the inherent moral imperative in humans. And Armaiti is the transcendent source of the activity that makes for harmony, for unity, and hence leads us to holiness and on to godliness. This primordial creative energy involves into the state we call matter, to manifestation, constricting consciousness at the same time. It then proceeds with evolution, culminating in fully enlightened consciousness and its own primal condition of the divine. Primordial creative energy, functioning in these fascinating modes in the context of infinity and eternity, functions universally and archetypally. The different modes interact amongst themselves. Our body is thus a wonderful apparatus through which unimaginable powers and faculties of transcendence can come to fruition, and have done so, and have done so in the perfected holy ones of the human race. Now, when mind interacts with matter in the form of the human body, psyche is born. Whereas pure mind is characterless, universal, nondescript, and unqualifiable in human language, psyche is specialized, individually possessed by you as truly as your own arms or head, and it is describable. Psyche is rooted in and influenced by our brain and nervous system, by the activity of our ductless glands, the condition of our blood, etc. In fact, our existential being, which is born, lives and dies, is a psychophysical organism, like every single cell in our body. Sir Charles Sherrington, one of our most distinguished neurophysiologists of this century, stated in his book, Man on His Nature, that if learnability, that is, the capacity to learn, is a sign of mind, then every single living cell in every body has mind, for cells can learn. He naturally used the word mind where I would use the word psyche. In my book, The Heart of Religion, I have introduced in some detail in chapter 17 what I have just presented. In my previous talk, I said that the evolution of our present isolative and separative consciousness, functioning in the strictly limited sphere of the finite and temporal, that is, in space and time, culminates in holistic consciousness which can function in the context of infinity and eternity. When this happens, your consciousness is functioning like Ahura Mazda's consciousness. In fact, it is completely blended with the divine consciousness. Since, in the context of the infinite eternal, there is no separativeness or isolativeness, no otherness, it is Ahura Mazda, God, transcendence, that is functioning freely through you. Your psyche is so purified that it is transmuted. It is one with the divine Sravashi, with the Spaintamainyu. So we can begin to understand Zarathustra's affirmations, such as, when I beheld thee in my very eyes, Yasna 31:8. Now I can see Ahura Mazda himself, Yasna 45:8. When the good mind encircled me completely, Yasna 43:11-15, etc. So too we can understand the Upanishadic Aham Brahma Asmi, the Buddha's affirmation that his title of Tathagata is tantamount to Brahma Bhuta, become Brahman, to Dhamma Bhuta, become the law, Asha. And Jesus Christ's affirmation, I and the Father are one. St. John's Gospel 10:30. In my books, I have called this the realization of transcendence, or being touched with the lightning of transcendence. When this happens, even if it is only once in your lifetime, an indelible impression is made on your whole organism. In course of time and under favorable conditions, this impression gives rise to profound, unerring insights, which then take shape as original ideas clothed in appropriate and beautiful language. But all this can happen only when the psyche is utterly purified, utterly emptied of all evil and falsity, and thereafter stands truly shining in all its naked splendor. This is the meaning of the halo round the head of Zarathustra and of all the perfected holy ones. This realized divinity and truth, giving rise to pure and inspiring religious teaching, is the meaning of God and man conversing with each other. In your fully enlightened and enlightening holistic consciousness, you yourself are Ahura Mazda. The verbal teachings which emerge in consequence of the revelation, which is God's language, through your brain and mouth in your ordinary worldly state, operating through the activity of all your senses and brain and mastery of language. For example, Krishna and Arjuna are one and the same person, namely the writer of the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna Dvaipayana Veda Vyasa. He personified his own transcendent holistic state as Krishna and his ordinary mortal state as Arjuna. Meditate serenely and deeply enough to realize its profundity on the 37th shloka of the 10th discourse of the Gita. Krishna says to Arjuna, "Of the Vrishnis, Vasudeva am I. Of the Pandavas, Dhananjaya, that is Arjuna. Of Munis, that is the silent sages, I am Vyasa. And of poets, I am the poet Ushana." Holistic consciousness is the condition of revelation in which you are, as it were, cradled in God's omniscience. This holistic consciousness descends into the human condition of ordinary discriminative consciousness in order to communicate the message of that revelation to our fellow human beings. In this descent from holistic to ordinary human consciousness, several grades of divinity are unavoidably shed, because transcendence in its own supremely transcendent state is not identical with its manifestations. Hence, the message expressed in thought and word inevitably loses some of its transcendental dimensions of revelation. Nevertheless, even this enfeebled message is charged with such power and truth and beauty that it outlasts the deadening influences of frail mortality through 100 generations, and remains as fragrant throughout its age-long blossoming as in its primal emergence. As a noble example, take Zarathustra's teachings lasting over 35 centuries and now being revivified. Revelation, rooted in the spaceless and timeless deeps of the infinite eternal, is of the very substance of religious fulfillment. It marks the fruition of the religiousness which essentially distinguishes man from all other species. It is the evidence of the wholly purified psyche and of the perfectly matured mind. Revelation is the voice of God, Ahura Mazda, the divine voice that never uses human words, but is the mysterious spiritual energy which transmutes your worldly consciousness into holistic consciousness. Zarathustra fully realized this consciousness, this state of divine revelation, again and again as he prayed standing in front of the sacred fire. That fire, like any fire, was just burning wood, but it became sacred by the sanctifying presence of Zarathustra in communion with Ahura Mazda. What an awesome and inspiring example to all true priests of God in all the religions of the world. I have already quoted some of Zarathustra's affirmations of his realization of holistic consciousness. And here is another affirmation confirming this, but putting it in the form of a question to Ahura Mazda in the Ahunavaiti Gatha, Yasna 31:16. When the wise man strives earnestly for the increase of Asha, would he then, by such action, become one with thee, that is, be merged into thee, O Ahura Mazda? Having realized this transcendental beatitude himself, Zarathustra says in Yasna 31:19, "Whoso listens to and realizes Asha, that is, perfect virtue, becomes the soul-healing Lord of Wisdom, O Ahura." Note very carefully the soul-healing Lord of Wisdom. Ahura Mazda is Lord of Life and Wisdom. Hence, whoso becomes the soul-healing Lord of Wisdom is the one who becomes united with Ahura Mazda. He is the vicegerent of God, the heaven-sent messenger of God. He is the Holy One appointed to redeem man by healing his psyche and to lead him to the fulfillment of his divine destiny, of which perhaps the most important aspect is the transmutation of his worldly consciousness into holistic consciousness. Whatsoever is conceived or desired in holistic consciousness becomes manifest, because the true creative power and formative energy of pure mind springs into action and the shape and substance of what is desired or conceived comes into being. But remember that this desiring and conceiving at a transcendental level is of a totally different kind, because it is immediately productive from the conceiving and desiring of ordinary mortals whose consciousness is separative and isolative. In this connection, consider Yasna 19 verse 15, where Ahura Mazda discourses on the Ahuna Vairya, the creative word, to Zarathustra. The verse states, "The most excellent Ahura Mazda proclaimed the Ahuna Vairya. The most excellent, the eternal, caused it to be repeated after him." Owing to a pause, evil originated, but he restrained the wicked one with this interdict: "Neither our thoughts, sayings, intellects, creeds, etc. agree." What a remarkable lesson there is here for us at our level of development. In those words, "owing to a pause, evil originated." Our whole practice of Asha is summed up in that superb triad, Humata, Hukta, Varishta. That trinity represents for us humans, in our limited sphere of the finite and mortal, that which the constant vibrating of the spiritually empowered Ahuna Vairya by Ahura Mazda represents in the infinite and immortal sphere. If, then, our good thinking, good speaking, and good doing were to slacken or falter even for a single instant, evil can enter into our living process, and an ill state of mind and body can arise. We have the saying, "The devil hath work for idle hands." Much more true is this for the idle mind. Eternal vigilance is essential for living the holy life, the truly Zarathustrian life. Amongst the founders of the great religions, Zarathustra is the one example of a fully qualified priest, a Zaltar, as he calls himself in Yasna 33:6, and a Mantran in Yasna 32:13, who was also a Ratu, Yasna 31:2, a prophet. There is a hint in Yasna 33:4, which indicates that he probably had psychic powers. He says, "Therefore, O Mazda, I will pray away doubt and ill intent from thy worshippers, perversity of mind from the self-reliant, hostility of the nearest kin from the co-worker, slander from the friend, and the false teacher from the land." If the words, "I will pray away," indicate that he could exorcise evil spirits, Zarathustra's psychic power is the white magic of the pure magus. In this context, Zarathustra's praying away is not a mere mumbling of the words of the prayers. It is a projection of spiritual healing and creative energy out of his holistic consciousness. Otherwise, a gramophone record repeating the Ahuna Vairya could do the trick. Let us consider again Zarathustra's phrase, the soul-healing Lord of Wisdom. That verse proceeds as follows. As for words propounding the true doctrine, he will be capable and eloquent of tongue through thy radiant fire, O Mazda. English dictionaries define soul as the principle of life, as feeling, thought and action in man, and hold it to be separate from the body, the spiritual part of man believed to survive the death of the body. Now that which is spiritual, or which is pure mind, is always holy. It needs no healing. So I prefer to use the word psyche instead of soul. For, as explained earlier, the psyche is rooted in the material brain and nervous system, is influenced interiorly by the ductless glands, bloodstream, etc. In short, by the electrochemistry of the body, and exteriorly by events and circumstances. Our thoughts and feelings, desires and intentions are psychical expressions, sometimes good, but sometimes evil, rather unfortunately. So it is the evil or deranged psyche that needs healing, not the soul. The words Ahum Bish in the text of Yasna 31:19, according to footnote 3 on page 55 of the songs of Zarathustra by our revered Dasturji Framrose Bode and our distinguished scholar Pilu Nanavati, says that Ahum Bish is variously interpreted as the dual life, the two lives, and the physician of life. The etymology is obscure. Our two authors, following the Swedish scholar H. S. Nyberg, chose the translation the physician of life. Soul healing is the translation given by the late Dr. Irach J. S. Taraporwala. I prefer psyche healing for this reason. I have observed in my lifetime that he who listens attentively to the truth, to Asha, and diligently lives by it, experiences the fiery process of the perfect cleansing of the psyche. This releases the hitherto dormant, inherent wisdom of the good mind, our Vahumana within us.